You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market reminds you that every bite has a story. So whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. At Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make helps us to support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. More information at wholefoodsmarket.com. Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host, and I am a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, amongst other things. And we are broadcasting live tonight from behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So do you remember a movie that came out probably about 20 years ago called L.A. Story? Remember that? Steve Martin made it. And I think he directed it, wrote it, and he also starred in it. And in it, Steve Martin plays a weatherman, a meteorologist, at a TV station in Los Angeles. And every day he goes to work at his radio station, and every day he gives his forecast, and every day it's exactly the same. It's sunny and 72 degrees because it's L.A. And it was like some, you know, absurd Groundhog Day kind of thing, the movie Groundhog Day, not the actual day, where the weather never changed. He would go into work every day. He would give his weather report every day. It was exactly the same. And actually, when I saw the movie, I loved it the first time I saw it. And then I saw it again, and I loved it. And then I saw it again 20 years later, and it didn't really hold up that well. But it had some good stuff in it. But anyway, that was sort of how this past summer felt to me, except instead of being sunny and 72, it was unbearably hot and humid and 93. Forever. It seemed like it went on for months and months. And it seemed like it never rained at all. Just an endless stretch of brutal humidity and heat. And I think it was one of the driest summers on record. And I think it was almost the hottest summer on record. I think we were off by like a tenth of a degree on one day or something like that. But then it started to rain. On Sunday, it started raining. And it seems like it hasn't stopped raining since. Even now, it's kind of gray and cool and drippy out there. And so I got off the subway last night. I got off of work. I'm working nights, and I was walking home at about 10:30, and it was actually kind of chilly out. Like, it felt cool, and I thought, this doesn't feel like the end of August. What's going on? And when I woke up Monday morning in the pouring rain, I had this distinct deja vu kind of flashbacky feeling of how it always felt to me on the first day of school. Not in any particular year, just that kind of uneasy, queasy feeling that the first day or the first week of school always brought. It always seemed like suddenly the weather had changed from warm and sunny and summer weather to gray, cloudy. It was like symbolic. You know, it was first day back to school and the weather sucked. Or it was so beautiful that you hated having to go back to school. But it seemed like it always rained that day. And so when I woke up on Monday and it was pouring rain and I went outside, the air had a very distinctive smell of new number two pencils and social anxiety, which was how the first week of school always smelled to me. So even though here in New York, the kids don't go back to school until after Labor Day, I know that in other parts of the country, the kids are already back at school. I think down south, people go back to school at the end of August. And so since it's back to school time and the stores are filled with school supplies and all the ads are for back to school shopping, I thought it would be a good time for us to start off the school year by taking a quiz. A quiz to see what you've all learned and retained over this long, hot summer of radio listening. Now, hopefully you've been listening to the show all summer and you've been studying and taking notes, because now you're going to be quizzed on it. So go and get your new speckled composition books, you know, those black and white composition books, and get a fresh pencil and make sure it's sharp. And make sure you take a good long whiff of the smell of the fresh pencil shavings, because everybody loves that smell. And let's take the first quiz of the year. Are you ready? It's a fruit quiz. Did you eat a lot of fruit this summer? That was part of your homework. I hope you did. Okay, here we go. The fruit quiz. And I'll be giving you the answers at the end of the question. So no need to send them in. Okay, question number one. Do peaches continue to ripen after they are picked? Well, anybody know? Okay, so in all fairness, this is more of a question of semantics or terminology. It's almost a philosophical question in a way, because it all depends on how you define ripening. It's like when Bill Clinton was being impeached. Get it? Impeached? I just realized the pun on that. Impeached. What's the actual meaning of impeached? Doesn't have anything to do with peaches. Anyway, when Bill Clinton was being impeached or having his impeachment hearings, they asked him a question about something and he said, it all depends on what the meaning of is. So whether peaches get riper or not after they're picked all depends on how you define ripeness. I say yes, they get riper because they get softer and they get sweeter. And to me, that's ripening. A peach farmer who was asked in this, in my research, said no, they just get softer. They don't actually continue to ripen, they just get softer. So I decided to go straight to the source. And here's the official line on the matter given to me by the Peach Thought Police, the source. The California Tree Fruit Agreement Group. That's what they're called. So the official quote from the California Tree Fruit Agreement is, we, the California California Tree Fruit Agreement, term what happens on the tree maturity and what happens off the tree ripening. As the fruit ripens, softening being part of that, the sugar levels remain the same. But the perceived sweetness of the fruit changes as the acid levels drop. So the peach farmer says, ripens on the tree, softens on the table. I say, ripens on the tree, ripens more on the table. The California Fruit Tree Agreement says, matures on the tree, ripens on the table. Now, in 100 words or less, tell me, what would Kafka say about how fruit trees ripen? Actually, it's not an essay question. It's okay. You see how it's sort of a philosophical thing? It all depends on how you define ripening. It's all about what is. All I know is that I've eaten some really, really good peaches this year, but I've also eaten some really bad peaches this year. But the peaches I've had have been so good that this is actually the second or third show this month where I've mentioned them. And I'm sure you're all getting a little tired of peaches, so next week, no peach talk. Although I will be on All Things Considered on National Public Radio coming up this week talking about peaches. So there'll be even more peach talk coming up, which is why I did some of this peach research, because they want to talk about ripening. But after that, that's it, because peach season will be over and we'll move on to apples and I'll leave it alone for a while. But anyway, so do peaches continue to ripen after they're picked or not? Well, I don't know. Some say yes, some say no. I know that when I leave my peaches out on the table, they get better. They get sweeter. They get softer. I don't detect a drop in acidity, but maybe it's happening and I am not aware of it. I don't know. But I do know that no matter how ripe I buy the peaches, if I leave them sitting out a day or two, they get better. Okay, next question. Oh, actually, let's take a little break. And when we come back, we'll move on to the next question. We'll be right back. listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, who would like to remind you that every bite has a story. Let's think before we eat, and let's retake our plates. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Remember that you can always listen to this show every Tuesday night live, but if you can't do that, you can also always podcast the show on iTunes. You could even subscribe to the podcast, or you can listen to any Heritage Radio Network show archived on the heritageradionetwork.com website. You can also leave comments for any of our shows on the website, and I personally love getting the comments. I want to hear from you. I want to know that people are listening. I'd also like to know what your quiz results are. So tonight, we're having a little quiz. It's back to school week, and we are taking a quiz based on things I've talked about this summer on my show, primarily having to do with fruit. Okay, so our first question was about peaches and about ripening, and now we're moving on to melons. So question number two, the subject is melons. Which melon is the only type that continues to ripen off the vine? Think about this carefully. Got it? Right. It's the cantaloupe and muskmelon family. Is that what you answered? Did you get that? They're the only ones that continue ripening because they have that meshy, porous outer web that coats them. They don't have a hard shell like watermelons. Watermelons, cantaloupes, they have that hard shell. They're almost like pumpkins. They're in that same family. And it's so impermeable that it doesn't allow gases to pass through and ripen, whereas cantaloupes have a gas-permeable membrane. So they continue to ripen. But then again, that brings us back to what does ripening actually mean? When we were talking about peaches, we had some discussion about what ripening means. According to certain authorities, ripening just means softening and reduction of acid. It's really hard to say. But when you want to pick out a good cantaloupe will let you know that it's ripe by a couple of sensory clues. So first of all, behind its meshy web, the background color should be yellow, not green. If you see green, it's not ripe. Get the most evenly yellow one that you can find. And when melons are ripe, they basically just detach themselves from their vines. They just fall off the stem with just like a little nudge. And so where they're attached to the stem, there's like an indent. It's almost like a belly button. And it should be very smooth in there and indented. It should be concave and smooth. If there's any little stumpy stem left to it, that means it had to be pulled off the vine and it wasn't ready to give it up yet. They basically give up when they're ready to give up. Same as tomatoes. Tomatoes should just fall off the vine with just the lightest touch. And of course, the big question or the bonus question with ripeness in melons is when in doubt, what do you do? If you're not sure of it, of the visual clues the melon is giving to you, what should you do? You should smell it. You should get used to smelling everything. Not everything. But when you're shopping, I shop often by smell. So smell it. Does it smell like ripe fruit? Then there's a good chance it is ripe. It should have a kind of perfumey, sweet, melony smell, not a nothing smell or not a green smell. And usually that gets you a really good melon. Although I have to tell you that last week's show, I talked about what a gamble buying fruit is, what a crapshoot it can be, and how often I've wound up with really sucky fruit. And 2 weeks ago, I was at the Peekskill Farmers Market, which is where I spend my weekends, and I bought a cantaloupe from the guy who I call the fake Amish guy. He's some kind of weird Pennsylvania culty thing, but I don't think he's Amish. I don't think he's real Amish. He's like pretend Amish. And most of the year I avoid his stand because the produce that he sells looks, to me, it looks suspiciously industrial. It doesn't look like farm produce, but this time of the summer, he gets produce and that looks like farm produce. It looks real. So I give him a shot. And normally he has these unbelievably great cantaloupes, and I got one a couple weeks ago and it was spectacular. It was like a perfect melon. So this week I went back, he had these melons. They were beautiful. They smelled like perfume. They were yellow as can be. I bought one. I took it home. I cut it open. It was awful. It was practically fermented on the inside and mealy. It was really bad. It was one of the worst. I had to throw it in the woods into the compost heap. So I always say, when in doubt, smell your fruit. But, you know, like life, fruit is a game of chance and a game of randomness. And while I say trust your nose, I also always say taste before you commit. In almost everything in life, if you taste before you commit, you'll make better choices. I wish I had tasted that melon first. But then I went to our local A&P, and for 99 cents, I got a melon that was local, and that one was great. So there's really, you know, it's a total crapshoot with fruit. So anyway, this is sounding less like a quiz, but the question still is, how do you determine ripeness of a melon? First of all, go by smell. Look for that golden background behind the web. And give it a feel, too. It should feel heavy. Melons should feel really heavy for their size. It shouldn't feel light. Okay. So that's the melon question. So we're talking about fruit. And we're having a quiz about fruit. And we're going to leave the whole kind of local and seasonal thing behind momentarily to throw in a little question about another kind of fruit. Now, this was something I mentioned last week, so I want to see if you were listening. Okay, if you weren't listening, pay attention. So question number three on the fruit quiz is, what single item does Walmart sell the most units of worldwide, of every single thing that Walmart sells in its stores worldwide? What does it sell the most of? So if you listen to last week's show, like I said, you'll know the answer. I talked about this then. But when I learned this little bit of information, I was so blown away and so astounded by it that I can't leave it alone. I'm a little bit stuck on it. So I've been asking everybody I know to see if they can guess this answer. I asked my students at ICE, and I got a lot of really funny answers from them. Answers like gum or tires. And the best one I got was guns. Walmart sells more guns than anything else that they sell. But that's not true, although I would have thought it was guns too. And then I asked my mom, who was visiting from Florida, Mom, what's the one thing that Walmart sells the most of anything else in the world? And she said, film? And I told her that she's a little techno-challenged. And I said, Mom, you yourself own a digital camera. When's the last time you bought film? I said, you should think a little harder about answering before you answer a quiz. Okay, so do you think you know the answer to this? Okay, you have 5 seconds. Okay, done. Pencils down. The answer is bananas. Yes. The single most purchased item bought by the piece at Walmart worldwide is the banana. Unbelievable, right? First of all, that they could even carry that many bananas and that they can procure that many bananas. You know how many bananas they would have to get? How many banana farmers are hustling to get their bananas to Walmart? It's kind of unbelievable. Okay, and like the peaches, I'm done with the banana question now. 2 shows have had the banana question. Don't worry, you won't hear it anymore. Sometimes I get a little bit obsessed with bits of trivia and I can't really leave them alone, but I'm done. And anyway, I personally avoid Walmart if I can at all help it. And I actually rarely buy bananas. But if I do, I get them at Trader Joe's. They're cheaper and they sell organic bananas. What's funny is somebody once complained to me at work that they had gone to the farmer's market at Union Square and nobody was selling any bananas or oranges. And I just gave them the look. The look that says, I can't help you with this. All right, another little quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue with the fruit quiz. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And it's back to school week on Why We Cook, so we're taking a quiz. It's a quiz to see how much knowledge you have retained over a summer of listening, hopefully listening to my show. So how are you doing on the quiz so far? Have you gotten them all right? It's not really that hard. If you've been paying attention all summer, you would know all these answers. Does anybody need a little break? No? Good, because we're still in session. You had the whole summer off, so pull yourselves back together and focus on the quiz. Okay, question number four. Which classic American fragrant flower is the first cousin of many of our favorite fruits? Think romance, think Valentine's Day. Ding! The rose, correct. Did you say the rose? Roses are a fruit. Well, roses are a flower, but they produce a fruit. But they are a very close cousin to apples, crab apples, pears, almonds, cherries, strawberries, raspberries. All of those are related to roses. Even plums, apricots, peaches, they're all roses. That's why so many of those fruits have beautiful, fragrant flowers, like cherry blossoms and peach blossoms. They're all roses. And roses themselves have a fruit too. Do you know what it's called? This could be a bonus question. The bonus question? It's called the rose hip. It's the fruit of the rose plant. So if you happen to find yourself driving along the West Side Highway of Manhattan or walking or biking along the path on the West Side Highway of Manhattan, you can see in the median that runs down the highway thousands and thousands of rose bushes that were planted there before the Great Recession wiped out the entire city budget. When things were great and we were flush and riding high, the city planted thousands of rose bushes along the West Side Highway. And now, late summer, those rose bushes are producing fruit. So the roses bloom, and then the bloom falls off, and that's when the fruit comes in, and the fruit is called a rose hip. And it's like a little bulging, orangey, round thing that happens right below where the flower was. And they look like little bulged out hips, little ladies' hips, which is why they're called rose hips. And rose hips are really interesting because nobody really eats them anymore. But if you take vitamin C, often your vitamin C comes from rose hips. Sometimes it comes from something called acerola, which is a kind of cherry. But often it's rose hip vitamin C. But nobody really eats them or collects them. Well, I shouldn't say nobody. I'm sure there are people who do. But they're extremely high in vitamin C. And they are full of pectin. And so that means that if you pick them and you make jelly with them, or jam with them, it'll set up into a really nice firm gel without you having to add any commercial pectin to your jam or your jelly, because pectin is what makes fruits thicken in jam or in jelly. If you use low pectin fruits, you have to add pectin to make it solidify. Otherwise, you just get sauce, not jelly. So in colonial times, rose hips were a really important food for early Americans because it was how they got their vitamin C. They were not likely to see a citrus fruit in their region or in their era, you know, for a long time. There was going to be no citrus fruit eaten in the Northeast for hundreds of years. And so people knew that if they ate these rose hips, they would get their vitamin C from them and they wouldn't get scurvy. Now, if you were interested in finding rose hips, you could go now and walk along the West Side Highway of Manhattan and you could pick pounds and pounds and pounds of them. They're there for the taking, although I'm sure it's actually illegal for you to go and pick them. I wouldn't recommend picking them, though, because you have to think that they've absorbed so much car and truck exhaust growing in there that they're probably not so good for you. But every time I drive by there, it just sort of strikes me as this tragic waste of a really valuable, nutritious food that we just let kind of rot on the vine every year. It seems really wasteful. Oh, well. Okay, so we're running out of time in the fruit quiz tonight, but I have one more question, and it's back to melons again. So it's watermelon season now, and there are a lot of great watermelons out there. But how do you tell that you've picked a good watermelon? Do we know? First of all, you want to pick it up because it should be heavy for its size. Like the cantaloupes, you want that melon to feel substantial. It should feel really heavy. And then you should thump it, like with your fist. Give it a little rap, and you should hear a really solid sound. It shouldn't sound hollow, but it also shouldn't sound like a dull thud. It should have a good, like, resounding thud to it. And then what you want to do is turn the melon around, and you want to see that it has a brown spot, sort of a yellowy, whitish brown patch. That's the patch where the melon sat on the ground as it ripened. And the longer that melon sat on the ground ripening, the bigger that spot's going to be. So you actually are looking for a blemish on the fruit. And the bigger that blemish is, with the case of a watermelon, the better. It's unlike a lot of other fruits. So you want to look for that. That should pretty much guarantee you that you're getting a good melon. Now, remember that they don't continue to ripen once they're picked, because which melon continues to ripen? That's right, the cantaloupe. But hard-shelled melons don't. So you have to make sure you're getting a good one. But now what I have found, because we like to buy a watermelon every week of the summer, and what we found in my house is that after we cut into that watermelon and eat some of it and put the rest of it away, it actually starts to taste better after a couple days in the fridge. And I think what's happening is you get some enzymatic action going on, and the fruit starts to break down just a tiny bit, and it seems to get sweeter. Now, maybe it's like the peaches, where the acidity is dropping as it sits and breaks down. Whatever it is, I think it actually tastes better. And it gets to the point where it's like right on the brink of almost tasting fermented, but it's not. And that's where I really like it. And then at that point, what I really like to do is eat the watermelon with something salty. Either just put a little bit of salt on it, or eat it with feta cheese, or even like a little fish sauce. And you get this really good balance, because the watermelon starts to get so sweet that it's almost cloying, but then you add a little bit of salt and it really balances it out. It's great. Okay, so that's the end of the fruit quiz. How did you do? Please tally up your score and send it to me at erica@whywecook.com. No, you don't have to send me your score, but I'd be interested to see if anybody actually took the quiz and whether you did well on it. If you knew the answers, hopefully you knew the answers because you've been listening all summer. All right, we have time for one last bonus round question. Here we go. Final bonus round. This is for an extra 100 points. What's the most widely and commonly eaten fruit in the world? Think of the whole world. Anybody know? It's the mango. More mangoes are eaten worldwide than any other fruit. I know, it's hard to believe. I would have probably originally said the banana, but it's the mango, because you have to remember that India has a lot of people and they love their mangoes. So I think a lot of them are eaten in India and in Asia. We are unfortunately out of time tonight. I hope you took the quiz and you did well on that. I want to thank Nat and Jack in the control room, and we will see you next week on Why We Cook. Thanks for listening.